We are dealing with God and skeptics, the idea that there are those who have been taught by the world to believe certain things, and we are encouraging them to doubt their doubts, that the doubts that they have are based on wrong information, that their thinking has been prescribed for them, and the idea, the killer idea is that all the smart people agree. All the smart people think this is the way of the truth. And yet, bit by bit, people have come to knowledge, actually researched these things and said, there's not much evidence for this, this skepticism. And so we're looking at seven reasons for faith. Last time, we were talking about the first one, which is the idea of congruency, the idea that there are some puzzles, there are some problems that we face in life, and the best answer is the one that answers all of those things, and that is there is a God. He created mankind. We are made in His image, and these things are the answer to those puzzles. This one today is dealing with the innate knowledge of God. This is also an answer to a puzzle, by a very particular one, and that is, why is the world given to some form of morality? Why does the world agree that and feel deeply that there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong? This is not understandable under the skeptic system. So we're going to be looking at this. The innate knowledge of God, looking at Romans 1:19. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, in the people. For God hath showed it unto them. That's what I mean by innate knowledge of God. All around the world there are people that say, I'm an atheist, I don't believe there's a God, and they are lying to themselves. Because we know that in every human being, God has placed the sense of knowledge of Himself. And so this is, you know, as kids, I can't hear you, you know, they're just refusing to hear. And that's what's going on. They are saying, not that I have logically come to the conclusion there can be no God. That's a ridiculous concept. Well, how would you prove that? Where would you go to look for God? And you look under behind a tree and He's not there, so you say there's no God. Well, maybe He's behind another tree. Maybe He's under a rock. Maybe He's hiding on top of a house. How would you check every place? How would you check every place in the universe? And how would you check every place at the same time? You'd have to be God. So the question is, what they're really saying is, no thank you, no God for me, you know? Like, no dessert for me, you know? But no God for me. That's just saying, I don't want to have a part of that. I don't want to be involved in what it means if there is a God and He's demanding certain things of me. That's what they don't want. So we recognize here that God has shown things of God to everyone. It is innate. Now, some call this reason for faith the argument from morality. So we start with morality and we say, there's no reason for this to exist except that there is a God that put it in man. And sometimes it's called the anthropological argument, anthropos, the Greek word for man, mankind, men and women. And so the idea is, this is the way man is. The idea expands that to make something, to make a computer, you had to have people that were smart enough to understand how to deal with language, how to deal with electronics. You have to have somebody smarter than a computer to put it together. Now, the computer can be work out calculations faster and so on, but the computer can't be smarter than the people that put it together. Now, all of that to say, God shows Himself to be a person who's not only able to create, but has the knowledge of man, the knowledge of truth, the knowledge of speech, the knowledge of human life, and so is, since man was made in his image, God has something of an image of man. Now, let me introduce this by talking about two claims, one from the Bible, one from the skeptics, from the idea of secular humanism. First claim, the Bible claims that there is a God. He exists outside of time and space. He created the universe of time and space. So to create something is something that's not yourself. You're not creating yourself. So he created something outside of himself. All the material came by him, and then time itself was created. So he's outside of time and out of space. It claims that God made everything very good. He didn't damage what he was making. But something happened that changed all that. This is the Bible presentation of what's going on. So the first humans sinned, and a curse came over the universe. The curse is in this sense that they brought consequences upon planet Earth because of what they did. Death and death-dealing, death-causing conditions spread all over the world. It's an amazing thing to realize that there was no death before sin. Animals didn't eat each other, didn't eat mankind. There were ferocious animals. They just didn't eat each other. The idea, and it'll go back to that during the millennial kingdom, that in fact, the meat-eating animals will eat straw like cattle and so on. So decay, the relentless path to death, the second law of thermodynamics, that everything's running down, that became the law of the universe. God went to extraordinary lengths to rescue man from the cursed world because he had created man for loving fellowship with him. Why would he create man? It was that he might enable him to become part of his eternal family, to share the love that the triune God loved within themselves. And they recognized this was such a perfect state of being. They wanted to expand it to others. So they created other beings that could do that. So God has proclaimed, for instance, that murder is wrong because of the special purpose of man's creation. We are created in God's image. This is an interesting thing, by the way, that the arguments against capital punishment is that it doesn't do any good. Well, the point that God says is when they take human life, they are taking that which was made in the image of God. This means that their life should be taken. That is what the Bible claims. There's the claims of the Bible. And so morality is understandable in this regard because God set a standard. Man was given that standard, and then man chose to sin against it. Now, on the other side, secular humanism, with its evolutionary philosophy, claims that animals and man evolved from one-celled creatures. That the one cell finally became two cells, three cells, 10 cells, whatever it was. And then finally, it became a worm. And a worm became a snake, and I don't know how they work it. But eventually, ta-da, there was mankind. And the animals all came from the same source. Now, this means, it claims, that man is just another kind of animal. Like a tiger is a different kind of animal from a jellyfish. Just a different sort. Man, it says, is no better than other animals, even though he is smarter. That is the key to being human in their thinking. He's just a little smarter. Now, all of this to say that if we are then just animals, it asks the question, why do we think that there's a morality, that there's things we ought to do? Do you think a tiger goes through that as he chases down his antelope prey? Do you think that the elephant worries about that when he grabs up some grass with his trunk and stuffs it in his mouth? I wonder if I'm trespassing on somebody else's property. The elephant doesn't think that. So why does mankind have morality? This is the problem for them. Here's what they say. Some of the man animals have developed rules based on their culture. And others have developed very different rules based on their very different culture. Now, these differences, they say, should be respected and appreciated. And this is what secularism claims. All right, now we have the two claims. One is there's a God to answer to, and so he's told us what is right, and to do other than that is wrong. To the secular humanism, there is no real right and wrong, just rules that have been made for various reasons. So, the problem, conscience. Conscience is that attitude, this concept of knowing right and wrong, is the organ of moral obligation. Conscience is the organ of moral obligation found in men everywhere and in all time. Man has always been a person of conscience. I was amazed, and this entire series is based on the work by Timothy Keller, recently deceased. finally succumbed to his pancreatic cancer, I think it was. But he took 20 years of ministry to build a church in the middle of liberal New York City. Everybody said, you can't do that. They don't believe that stuff. And he found that during that time, young adults that he met had a strong sense of right and wrong. Now, they have moral outrage, in fact, over many things that are happening in our world. These are not amoral people. These are not people that don't care what's going on in the world. He found that these unsaved, very liberal, indoctrinated people held very strongly to certain things that were right, certain things that were wrong. Now, these people were not church members. They were unsaved, secular people of the city. Now, this condition of conscience is not the claim of the Bible. It's not the claim of secularism. It is just the manifest way of life on earth. Wherever you go, to whomever you speak, you may find people that say, I don't have any morality. But even then, you will find that there are things that they will not do that they think is wrong for others to do. So the question I'm asking, and that I want you to ask in your own thinking, is how can we account for this sense of moral obligation? Where did that come from? And we're going to be answering this by giving you four of the secular explanations. Now, before we do that, let's just ask, by what definition are we thinking of moral obligation? Let's go to sociologist Christian Smith. Here's in his Moral Believing Animals, Human Personhood and Culture, in his book, page 8, he says, moral is an orientation, a way of orienting yourself, toward understandings about what is right and wrong, just and unjust, that are not established by our own actual desires, not what we want or preferences, but instead are believed to exist apart from them, apart from self. That this is a law of right and wrong that goes beyond what we like and what we don't like, providing standards by which our desires and preferences can themselves be judged. What I like, what I don't like, can be judged by a moral standard, by a moral obligation. All right, this is what we're talking about. when people say, you shouldn't do that, it's wrong. They have made a moral statement. They say, this is what you should do because that's just right. They're making a moral statement, whatever they're talking about, recycling, you know, anything. This is a moral statement. Now, if you, talking to people personally, when you ask anyone if he believes that some things are very wrong, if he's open to you, he will name one or more terrible things. He's heard of people doing this. Trafficking of children for sex. No, that's terrible. See? So if you check with him, he will say that he considers these things to be wrong, even though some dictators or even some cultures practice them. The place dictators in Africa would go into rebel places and take the children, whack their arms off at the elbows. It wouldn't kill them, but you'd have all these handless children as the mark of terror if you dare to disobey the dictator. Well, do you think that should be practiced here? Well, no, you say, that's wrong. It's wrong to mutilate children just to show your power. Well, why do you think it's wrong is the question. Where do you get this moral understanding? So this universal characteristic, characterized by everybody, this universal characteristic of man is hard to explain from the secularist point of view. They present these four possible explanations. And on your handout here, you can write these down so that it'll stay with you. You can follow along in your thing here. There's a good name for it, I'm sure. Handout. All right, secular explanation number one. This goes with the evolutionary answer. Number one, moral altruism, morality, comes from a gene, G-E-N-E, from ancestors who survived in greater numbers. They say it's part of us, part of our genetic structure. And it came about because there was something about morality that helped people survive. And they survived, and so morality was bred into people. That's their conclusion. It's part of our genetic system bred into us because it included things that help people survive. Now, the survival of the fittest teaches that survival passes on the genes of success. The less fit a being is, the more likely he will die and not pass on his genetic code. So the weak ones are killed by the strong ones, and so it's the strong genetic system that lasts. That's the survival of the fittest. Of course, I always wonder about the weaker, maybe sickly rabbit that stays close to his hole while the athletic, healthy one goes running out across the field and he gets caught, where the wolf comes up and the sick one just jumps back in the hole, so he doesn't get eaten. So I don't know. At that point, smart makes him fit, you know. So anyway. Now, this leads us to ask this question of these who are making this explanation number one. How could morality, altruistic behavior, contribute to survival? How would that make them better surviving people? That they were moral. They made moral decisions. If we think about it, a sense of moral obligation must limit a creature's actions to those that he perceives as good. But if the creature has no moral limitations, he's free to do anything to survive. He can kill his own family if he needs to eat them. So which is surviving here? The moral one with limitations, or the amoral one with no limitations? Now, the secularist argues that the moral altruism gene assisted a tribe to survive by the willing sacrifice of individuals. You had some moral people that said, I will sacrifice myself so the tribe can survive. Well, that makes sense. That's a logical concept. But it does not explain the problem, because who died? Who sacrificed themselves? The guy with the morality, you see? And he did it for the people that weren't ready to die. They didn't have that moral gene. So the scientific consensus is that natural selection does not work on whole populations. It only works on individuals. You don't have tribal genes, you know. So when the moral gene person sacrificed himself for the tribe, his gene died. It was not available for the gene pool. So you can have moral people in there making sacrifices, but they were the ones who died. So their gene got wiped out. So this isn't answering the question very well. It's not well thought out. Only those who did not sacrifice themselves lived to pass on their genes. So that would weed out the moral gene concept. Others say, well, they just had it wrong. They argue that the moral gene brought indirect survival benefits to the ones that he helped. Well, okay, but that does not explain present day motivation to help when no one knows about it. The person who does right, but he does it secretly. He does what he does because he just feels that's right. And it doesn't bring him any fame. It doesn't bring him any wealth. It doesn't bring him accolades. How does that help anybody survive? Evolution must be ongoing. Supposed to be continuing on today. It doesn't make any sense. So we brand this, the evolutionary explanation fails. There's no way to work this out to where you have a morality gene that left us with this perhaps obsolete concept of morality. So let's move on to secular explanation number two. This changes a little bit, and that is number two. The sense of right and wrong, morality, is true only for the culture that evolved it. You have a group of people, and part of their morality is that you should wear shoes. But it's just their culture, you see. I was reading about missionaries who found that there was a tribe that felt that the stomach and the chest was the area that ought to be covered. And they went without pants or dresses or anything because that wasn't important. See? And that was their concept of morality. So it was a cultural thing, you see. So this argument claims moral obligation did not come from biological evolution, but from cultural evolution. That this is the result of a culture that we have accepted and grew up in that taught us to think this way. If you imagine the pictures of the daring swimsuits of the 1800s, you see those ladies and those things that go down to the ankles and all that, laughably decent by today's standards. Morality, they say, is as relative as my belief that my wife and my mother's potato salad is the best. Okay, you say you have an argument with that, but you know somebody else that makes better potato salad and you like it better. Well, that's fine. See, this is their idea of what cultural morality is. Let me just say this. The basic problem with this argument is that it establishes a thing that people can't live with. Dr. Francis Schaeffer was the one saying that a true philosophy of life is not only logically consistent in itself, but is something that people can actually live with. You can't live with this. I can give you this example. A lady, anthropologist, Carol Fleur Loben, she was thoroughly schooled in the cultural evolution of morality. That was the way she understood where morality came from. But she decided that her concept of cultural relativity was not as important as protecting human rights, and especially in her case, women's rights. So her problem was this, that even though she believed that the moral concept of equality for women, she could point to it, that came from Northern Europe in the 18th century, 1700s. She worked it out, traced it down. That's where equality for women came from, the belief. But she said, I don't care where it came from. I want to teach this to other cultures. I want to teach women's rights to other cultures that did not learn it from Northern Europe in the 1700s. In other words, what I think is right should be right for all cultures, was her concept. And you see what she means. If it's right, it's right, right? And she said, it doesn't matter where you came from. If you're doing this, it's just wrong. And that's the way we think. That's the real morality that is dominant in our thinking. You can't live with this idea, oh, well, they abuse women, but that's just their culture. God bless them. You just can't do that, you see. So in spite of her philosophy, she just knew her beliefs were better than the others. The idea of human rights teaches us that every human has inherent dignity and that others must order their lives according to that fact. The old saying about, I'm free to swing my arms around wherever I want, but my freedom ends where your nose begins. You see? That's the concept. And that's pretty universal, see? Why'd you hit me? I have a right to swing my arms wherever I want. No, you don't. Those who claim this to be true, cultural evolution, offer neither proof nor reason to accept it. And here's the thing. I think one of the things that the world has come to agree on is that the Nazis were bad. The Nazis did bad things, at least. They maybe thought they were doing the world a favor. But cultural relativism cannot condemn the racial genocide of the Nazis. This idea eliminates any morality that crosses cultural boundaries. Hey, they just walked to the beat of a different drummer, see? They just had their way of doing things. Killing Jews was part of it. Killing blacks was part of it. Killing Christians, especially Baptist pastors, killing those people. That's just part of their system, you know. Every man to himself. People are not willing to say that. That's going too far. But that's what they have to say if this was their solution to morality. So this argument fails because no action can be condemned outside of its own culture. And yet mankind knows certain things are just wrong. It's just wrong, no matter what their culture taught them. And make no mistake, the German culture was on board with this. Not that every single person liked it, but the German culture was on board. They had rejoiced in Nietzsche's philosophy that there is no morality. Hitler bred this into his troops, that they will know no limitations by sense of right and wrong, and that the being the supreme beings, the supermen, the Übermensch, this was what their life was all about, designing the supremacy of the German land people, and going back to the pre-Christian mythological foundations of Germany. This is part of their thinking. So we say this fails. It fails because it doesn't explain morality as it really exists and leaves anything outside of our own culture untouched by morality. Let's move on to the third explanation. The concept of human rights, they say, are bestowed by the vote of the majority. Morality, well, that's just the way things are because it's the view of the majority. That's what's right. What the majority says, that's what's right. The majority says, that's what's wrong. But my question is, where does this leave the man who wants to speak words contrary to the minority, to the majority? What if you don't agree with that? Does that automatically make you wrong if morality comes just from the majority? We're seeing that with the leadership in our country today, that if you disagree, you are wrong. If you don't go to the extent that they go to, you're giving misinformation. Must we accept the majority's decision to exterminate the minority? Do we have to get on board with that because that's the majority? As we think back, did not the majority keep slaves? Did not the majority restrict the civil rights of the blacks? Did not the majority refuse to allow women to vote? Of course it was a majority. This explanation takes us right back to agreeing with Nazi Germany. You take a vote at that time in Germany and they would say, yeah, this is right. So that would be moral. You can't get to the root of true morality by saying it just came by following the majority. So this argument fails because whenever a majority claims something is moral or immoral, this argument allows the oppression of the minority. And for the most part, most people see the little guy needs defending. They see that his lesser attitude ought to be protected. That's their sense of morality. Very contrary to the idea of morality by majority. And the final one is this. They say, forget morality. Forget explaining and accept the fact that there is no morality. There is no right and wrong. So just face the facts. There's no God. There's nobody to say who's boss. There is no morality. This philosophy demands that we accept and live by the standard of nature. So on the playground, somebody tells the bully to stop torturing the younger boy, and he asks belligerently, says who? You gonna make me? And the question is, who has the right to make him stop? If he's decided to do this, and he's the bigger, stronger person, he can do it, why should he stop? We'll call a teacher to make him stop. All right, what we've said is the teacher's bigger, stronger, and if not, we'll get some other teachers that altogether are bigger and stronger, and that makes him stop, so we have agreed that might makes right. That the more powerful one tells other people what's right. And you better believe it, or I'll punch you in the nose. Or some other vulnerable place. We're back to Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, who proclaimed that man had outgrown the need for the concept of God. He said, God is dead. And that's not all he said. He said, and if God is dead, all morality based on love is groundless. Love is an emotion. Love is basically desire. You take what you want, that's your love. Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Sartre's Aimé Sartre argued that there is now no good reason to be kind, no good reason to be loving, no good reason to work for peace. Just fight it out until the strongest survive. When writer Annie Dillard lived for a year by a creek in the mountains of Virginia, she had some preconceived concept. She expected to get close to nature and to be inspired. Instead, she observed that the principle of violence by the strong against the weak dominates nature. She wrote in her conclusions of this experience, she said, there's not a person in the world that behaves as badly as praying mantises. They just eat each other. And this left her wondering. She wondered if nature is wrong and only humans are right, or if nature is right and humans are freaks that rage against the way things really are. See, this leaves us in a pretty bad place, doesn't it? Here's my conclusion. Are we then to abandon civilization and urge everyone to hide behind a tree and shoot at everybody else? Strongest survive. Maybe there are no trees left. Hide behind dumpsters. Are we to conspire to oppress others that we may rule in luxury? No? Why not? Why try to prove yourself good or better when, hey, look, there's no one on the judge's bench. There's nobody to say right or wrong. From the secularist viewpoint, there is no logical reason. You say, well, they believe in morality. Yes, but why? Ask them why. I was talking to a fellow about this, and he said, well, surely there was some sort of morality before Christianity. I say, well, yeah, cultural stuff, yeah. But nothing like we understand today. Nature is violence. It is actually a dog-eat-dog world. Why is it that we humans cannot live like this? Why is it we humans have moral outrage over evils in the world? There's only one reason. It's because the secular philosophy is wrong. God does exist. Change the premise. The Bible explains it to man. God hath showed it unto them. God said, be ye holy, for I am holy. 1 Peter 1:16. You know this to be true in your heart. How? God put it there. Let's pray. Father, you've given us an opportunity to ask the question, if all of this is true, and if we do discount the being of a God and the writing of the truth in the Bible, why are we concerned about people being right or wrong? Why do we hold that some actions are right and others wrong? we have cut the foundation out from underneath us, and our sense of morality is just the way we want things. And we can have no reason to tell people why they should obey us rather than themselves. If every man is the rule unto himself, then we have no morality to share with one another. I ask, Father, you might help us to be concerned with this, because this is not just a philosophy lesson. This is the way people exist today. There are those who are on board with the evolutionary idea that if I can kill you, then I will be ahead. If I can steal from you, I will be the richer. I ask, Father, that you might help us then to recognize that putting you back on the throne in our lives is the reason why we say certain things are right and certain things are wrong. That man and man's life is precious because you created him in your own image. With heads bowed, eyes closed, I wonder if you're saying, Pastor, I have not considered that our very sense of morality has come from God and is communicated into our very hearts by him as he made us this way. God helping me, I'm going to understand this, to explain to others and to ask others, where do they get their morality? Where do they get their right to say something is right or wrong if they have rejected the God who put it in their heart? If that's your prayer, to grow in this area, I wonder if you just slip your hands up, say, pray for me. Pray for me to take a stand for God by recognizing that morality is senseless unless it comes from God. Father, we ask that you might strengthen us to take a firm stand on what is right and what is wrong, because you are God and we are not. We pray thy blessing upon us in Jesus' name. Amen.